Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It is Friday, April 2nd, 2021. Every week we check in with Publishers Weekly for the latest news from the world of publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me today with his news and analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So this week opened with a bang, Andrew, when we learned that HarperCollins is acquiring the trade book division of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
Yeah, big news indeed. You know, after losing out to Bertelsmann's Penguin Random House in its bid to buy Simon & Schuster, News Corp and its HarperCollins subsidiary announced this week that it has reached an agreement to buy the trade publishing division of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt for $349 million in cash. Our listeners will recall that HMH put its trade division up for sale last fall as part of a strategy to focus more on its educational technology business. In 2020, that division had the trade division of HMH, I should say, had $191 million in revenue, and it was generally considered to be what we call one of the mini majors. In other words, HMH, I think, was the sixth largest trade publisher outside, of course, the Big Five, which is, of course, about to become the Big Four once Penguin Random House's acquisition of Simon & Schuster is complete. And I guess we can now say that of the top six trade publishers, which included HMH, they're about to be reduced down to four if we factor in Harper's bid to acquire HMH.
PW editorial director Jim Milliot reported at length this week about the acquisition. Andrew, can you share with us briefly what the deal is likely to mean for Harper and for Houghton Mifflin Harcourt?
Yeah, so it may not be the big fish that HarperCollins wanted, which was Simon & Schuster, of course, but it's a solid deal for HarperCollins as a company that has really shown, I think, a shrewd eye for a good buy going back over the years. You know, for example, its acquisition of Harlequin. HMH has a backlist of more than 7,000 titles. It's particularly strong in children's publishing, and as well as literary fiction and a number of nonfiction areas, including cooking and lifestyle. And in 2020, I think HMH's backlist accounted for 60% of its revenue. I think I have that figure right. And HarperCollins CEO Brian Murray told PW that that was the top attraction of HMH, its backlist. And he stressed that HarperCollins was in a better position to sort of exploit and cash in on that trade catalog than HMH would have been, you know, as it made this shift towards becoming more of an educational publishing company. In addition to boosting Harper's sales, News Corp in a release said it expects to be able to find cost savings of about $20 million when it does the integration of HMH into HarperCollins. And of course, cost savings probably means layoffs, which is unfortunate and not good news for some of the workers at these companies. But of course, that almost always happens when these mergers happen. HMH executive said it expects to receive net cash proceeds of about $337 million from the sale, which they say they're going to use to pay down debt. And the deal leaves us now, I think, you know, this is my perspective here, with two really big companies in what will be the Big Four that we'll have sometime in 2021. In the fiscal year that ended June 30th, Harper reported sales of $1.67 billion and earnings of $214 million. And in the quarter that just ended, December 31st, 2020, the company reported a historic rise in sales. Sales were up 23% and profits were up 65%. Through the first half of fiscal 2021, HarperCollins, of course, is on the half-year fiscal plan. I think its fiscal year ends in June. HarperCollins' revenue was just over $1 billion. So it's on track to be a $2 billion company in 2021. And the addition of HMH Books and Media are going to put its sales, I think, right around that $2 billion mark. So that kind of leaves Hachette and Macmillan really pretty far behind the big two, which of course would be Penguin Random House and HarperCollins.
And this deal among competitors will need to be approved by antitrust regulators. PRH's bid to acquire Simon & Schuster had already set off alarms over the effect of industry consolidation. Will this deal face those same concerns?
Yeah, I think there's no question that there's going to be critics that are going to urge the DOJ to step up and challenge not only the PRH and Simon & Schuster deal, but this deal as well. But again, even with this ramp up of antitrust rhetoric that we're seeing, I just don't see these deals being spiked. You know, I just don't think we're quite to the point where we're going to see this kind of action in the publishing sector before we see action in some other sectors. So yeah, Amazon, I'm looking in your direction. The tech sector, for example, is where I think we'll see it first. And this week, there were a couple of developments that drew attention. The first was the filing of a new antitrust suit by the prominent class action firm Higgins Berman. And that name should ring out to listeners because this is a suit on behalf of a potential class of booksellers that alleges another price-fixing conspiracy between the Big Five and Amazon.
And you reported last Friday in PW about that suit right after it was filed late last week in the New York courtroom and after we had recorded our weekly show. So tell us more.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, the law firm that is currently leading the sprawling class action price fixing suit against Amazon and the Big Five publishers in the ebook market, our listeners will recall we talked about that recently, has now filed a second lawsuit, this one on behalf of booksellers. But where the previous suit alleges price fixing in the digital market, that's ebooks and digital audio, this new suit, which was filed on March 25th in the Southern District of New York by lawyers at Higgins Berman, accuses Amazon and the publishers, which is Hachette, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Simon & Schuster, and Penguin Random House, of a conspiracy to restrain price competition in the online and retail print book market, with Evanston, Illinois-based indie bookseller Bookends and Beginnings, named as the initial named plaintiff here, on behalf, of course, of a potential class of booksellers. So similar to the claims that were made in the recently filed ebook price-fixing case by Higgins Berman, this suit also turns on Amazon's use of most favored nations clauses in its contracts with the Big Five publishers, which Higgins Berman lawyers claim have the intent and effect of controlling wholesale prices of print trade books and preventing any indie bookseller from competing with Amazon in the retail sale of print trade books. Now, the suit comes at an interesting moment, right? Because online print book sales, a market that Amazon absolutely dominates with a market share of over 90%, really grew in importance for indie booksellers in 2020 amid the pandemic. We had lots of curbside pickup, etc. And of course, the sales of these titles was facilitated by the emergence of an upstart group called bookshop.org, which we've also spoken about. And of course, we now have these two big mergers that are going to face additional scrutiny by regulators.
So many observers, Andrew, are scratching their heads over claims that publishers are colluding with Amazon. What do you make of it?
Well, no question, the collusion claim in the suits are somewhat puzzling, especially given that the Association of American Publishers, for example, has recently filed comments with regulators that call out Amazon's dominant role in the marketplace. But while the complaint acknowledges that the Big Five publishers have, and I'm going to quote the complaint here, indicated a preference to diversify from Amazon, the suit also claims that the publishers nevertheless are acting against their own self-interest and going ahead and participating in what the lawyers are portraying as a hub-and-spoke conspiracy coordinated by Amazon to restrain price competition in the market for print trade books. So as for what I make of it, well, antitrust law is complicated, so it's difficult for me to really evaluate this on the legal merits. It's difficult for antitrust lawyers to make sense of these things a lot of time. But I can say this much. You can ignore, you can ridicule, you can downplay the effect of this suit, but you do so at your peril because it comes from a firm, Higgins Berman, which of course was the first firm to sue Apple and five of the then big six major publishers for price fixing in 2011. And that case was also kind of downplayed and ridiculed, but it would eventually draw suits from a number of states and the Department of Justice, as well as a consumer class. And our listeners will recall the five publishers charged in that case ended up settling their claims for $166 million in credits, while Apple lost a trial and ended up paying out some $400 million to consumers. So my guess, as I've said before, is that Higgins Berman has a strong sense that the federal antitrust train against Amazon is getting ready to leave the station, and it's positioning itself for a prime role. Now, whatever you think the odds are of Higgins Berman actually prosecuting and prevailing in these actions, the odds, I think we would agree, are considerably higher that these suits are at least going to draw some federal attention, if not action. And if that happens, well, I think the chances are pretty good that you're going to get a settlement and that Higgins Berman is probably going to be involved in some way. You know, at the very least, as I had mentioned before, it draws attention to the mergers that are now at hand, which could be a real headache for Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster and HarperCollins and Houghton Mifflin. And I do want to call out the statement from the named plaintiff in the recently filed case, which is Nina Barrett, the owner of the Evanston, Illinois indie Bookends and Beginnings. And I'm going to quote her here. Let me grab this. "This is a situation that has been building for 20 plus years. We've all seen it happening, and nothing effective has been done to restrain it. And this is a quote that Barrett told Publishers Weekly, my colleague Claire Kirk. If there's an opportunity to approach it through class action, that's exactly the reason class action exists. No one bookseller can make a difference in a case like this, but I think it is a step toward collectively exercising power that will finally have a dramatic impact. So there you have it, the case for collective action being made by an indie bookseller in Illinois.
Penguin Random House has released final 2020 year-end results, Andrew, and like the publisher itself, the numbers were big.
Yeah, and we can finally tie up 2020 with a bow and make it a big bow at that. And once again, it was a very, very good year in terms of sales for publishers, and especially good for Penguin Random House. And we'll get to those numbers now. With strong revenues and strong profits in the US and in the UK, Penguin Random House sales increased 4.6%, which is a healthy margin. Total sales topped $4.46 billion. Now, remember, we were just talking about HarperCollins climbing into the number two spot and on pace to hit $2 billion in sales. Well, here's Penguin Random House at $4.46 billion, with Simon & Schuster to be added at some point in 2021, pending approval. So we talk about the big four, or maybe the big two. We should be talking about the big one, right? And maybe the large three at some point after that. You can read all about this the year that PRH had on the PW website. My boss, editorial director Jim Millia, did a good piece on it. And while we make a lot about PRH's size, I don't want to downplay how they had the success and the serious talent the organization has, right? So let me just say that, knowing some of the leadership and the people who work at Penguin Random House, they deserve congratulations on what was a tremendous performance throughout a year where we faced very uncertain circumstances with the pandemic. So, how good of a year was it, and what drove Penguin Random House's success? Well, big books help, right? And they had a huge book in Barack Obama's A Promised Land, which sold more than 7.3 million copies worldwide across all formats. We also saw higher sales of ebooks and digital audiobooks, as well as greater sales from online outlets. So I think the key is here, when you look at the numbers that Penguin Random House put up this year, in the past, some of its growth has been driven by acquisitions, right? But this year, it also posted really solid organic growth, up 6.7%. So Penguin Random House's distribution business also rose 7%. The U.S. business alone counted for almost 60% of total revenue. So those are just astounding figures, right? Those are figures that just point to a really good job done by the personnel at Penguin Random House. In a memo to employees, Penguin Random House Worldwide CEO Marcus Dooley, he didn't mention Simon & Schuster or that acquisition in his letter, but he alluded that there was indeed more growth to come in 2021, and he recognized that the publisher's future depends on a range of things, from the growth of online and e-commerce and digital channels, all of which have grown considerably amid the pandemic in 2020. And he pledged that Penguin Random House was going to steadfastly remain a loyal and reliable partner to physical bookstores. And that's a theme that Marcus Dooley has always stressed, going back to the initial Apple lawsuit a decade ago. Marcus is probably the most optimistic, energetic CEO of a publishing company that I know, and he's a great believer in the book business and its strength. And, he has a track record to back that optimism up. So, at this point, I'll just say congrats to the PRH team on what really was a remarkable year against the backdrop of great uncertainty.
And finally, news from Paris-based Hachette Livre, where global CEO Arnaud Nouri is suddenly out of a job.
Yeah, big news there as well, as Lagardère announced the appointment of Pierre Leroy as chairman and CEO of Hachette Livre, replacing longtime CEO Arnaud Nouri. Fabrice Bakhouche has been appointed the deputy CEO. The news comes just days after Nouri, who has been considered probably the most powerful person in French publishing, very publicly criticized the suggestion that Lagardère's publishing group could be broken up or merged with the Vivendi-owned rival Editis. In an interview with Le Monde last week, Nouri said that a merger with Editis made no strategic sense and warned that dismantling the publishing group should be avoided. So the fact that he's stepping down a couple of days later, probably not a surprise. So we're going to see what this all means for Hachette amid this drama playing out at the corporate level. At this point, I'll just say that I've had a few chances to talk with Arnaud Nouri over the years. We interviewed him from the stage at the Frankfurt Book Fair a few years back, and I really just admired him as a person. He's a very principled guy and a straight shooter. He's a real book guy. So Not sure what this is all going to mean for Hachette going forward. We'll just wish Arnone and Hachette the best, and we'll certainly keep an eye on developments there.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for joining me today with your analysis.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, the entertainment industry transition to a streaming-based economy remains a work in progress, even after 20 years, says Paul Sweeting, a veteran business journalist and industry analyst specializing in the intersecting worlds of media, technology, and public policy. While the music industry experienced financial carnage in the first decade of digital disruption, Sweeting says, streaming has restored the business to growth by playing your favorite song.
You know, it used to be the music industry was all about the hits, the current hits, because that's what drove record and CD sales. And that's where most of the money came from. In the streaming context, that's sort of been turned on its head. And it turns out that catalog product, that is songs and records that, you know, are over 18 months or 3 years old. It's now where most of the streaming revenue is being created. It's from streams of older catalog releases rather than the latest hits.
Why golden oldies are hot investments. Next on this CCC podcast. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.